I'm very excited actually to be here today. Basil has always been sort of a little bit of a legend ever since I started doing human animal studies, at least in my circles. So I'm excited to finally have the chance to present here as well, not just visit. I don't have a primary interest in animal sex actually. Instead, I came to questions related to sex via my interest in animals as self-willing, independent, indeterminate entities. And the term central for this question is today, of course, agency. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to provide this term with some more concrete texture through a reading of Darwin in the following. The shapes, forms, markings, and performances of animals are bountiful. Birds dance and flush their plumage, whales sing, bowerbirds work objects into intricately designed displays, alligators bounce water droplets on their back, cuttlefish put on iridescent shows of colors. The making of these features, the history of evolution, is a messy venture though. In Origin of Species, Darwin proposed, to monumental success, the concept of natural selection as the primary mechanism in the becoming of species. According to natural selection, as you, I'm sure, know, species are shaped by environmental pressure and the conditions to which individuals are exposed and with which they have to cope. The more successful they are in dealing with these circumstances, the greater their chances are to reproduce and thus pass on their specific, particular features to their offspring. As a consequence, the features of the more successful individuals, the ones that are adapted more beneficially to the conditions and challenges of their environment, are more likely to be passed on to following generations. Over long periods, this leads to species adapting in innumerable ways to the environments they are inhabiting. This view of the history of species is neither deterministic, nor does it require a perfect state of adaptation, an equilibrium that eventually would be achieved, although it has often been portrayed in this way. If environmental conditions change over a sufficiently prolonged period of time, and the changes remain within a certain degree, the species also change. Despite this indeterminism, however, there remain features and characteristics of animals, and even more so of humans actually, characteristics in external appearance, but also in behaviors, that do not seem to provide any direct benefit to survival or in the struggle for existence. Take, for a probably by now classic example, the large exuberant tails of male pheasants or peacocks. Beautiful and impressive as they are, these tails hardly provide an advantage for survival. Their size stymies the capacity of male peacocks to fly and thus seriously hampers their ability to escape from predators. Moreover, only male pheasants sport these tails. To explain their development by natural selection, hence, becomes at the very least difficult, because otherwise females would have them as well. As a consequence, Darwin proposed a second process that he saw at work in the modification of species, which is sexual selection. While he makes reference to sexual selection already in The Origin of Species, he provided a detailed study of and argument for its functioning in The Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex, which was first published in 1871. Because features such as the peacock's tail both are present in only one of the sexes and are in fact contradicting natural selection, Darwin assumed that they became so emphasized and pronounced because they were aesthetically preferred by the species' female members. By choosing individuals with larger tails over smaller tails, these features became emphasized over the course of generations because it were the individuals with large tails that received an advantage in producing offspring and passing on their features. In other words, female peacocks, for whatever reason, really like large exuberant tails. In relation to the species depicted here, Darwin wrote, and I quote, "The case of the male Argus pheasant is eminently interesting because it affords good evidence that the most refined beauty may serve as a sexual charm, and for no other purpose. We must conclude that this is the case, as the secondary and primary wing feathers are not at all displayed, and the ball and socket ornaments are not exhibited in full perfection until the male assumes the attitude of courtship. The Argus pheasant does not possess brilliant colors, so that his success in love appears to depend on the great size of his plumes, and on the elaboration of the most elegant patterns. Maybe also note the language Darwin is using, which is very different from what Andy Butterworth talked about yesterday, and sort of emphasizing this, that we need that this is not, when we go into history, there are several instances where we find that actually, and in someone as pronounced as Darwin. So what Darwin essentially proposed was that those characteristics in a species that were only related to the species reproduction were indeed a result not of natural selection, but of sexual selection. And although sexual selection acts in a less rigorous manner than natural selection, because the latter produces its effects by the life or death at all ages of the more or less successful individuals, and that was Darwin, sexual selection nevertheless in some instances even trumps natural selection, such as in the case of the peacock or pheasants. Not all characteristics related to reproduction, however, fall under the premise of sexual selection, and especially not those directly connected with the act of reproduction, which he refers to as primary organs of reproduction: testicles, vaginas, breasts, penises, nipples, ovaries, the various reproductive glands, and the like. And I quote Darwin again, "When the two sexes differ in structure in relation to different habits of life, they have no doubt been modified through natural selection, and by inheritance limited to one and the same sex." So again, the primary sexual organs and those for nourishing or protecting the young come under the same influence. So those individuals which generated or nourished their offspring best would leave the greatest number to inherit the superiority, or in maybe a little less charged terms, their better care. Whilst those which generated or nourished their offspring badly would leave but few to inherit their weaker powers. End quote. Because primary sexual organs are directly related to the ability and success of species to produce and rear offspring, from the act of fertilization to the safekeeping and raising of the young to maturity, they are a result of external environmental conditions and thus natural selection. This extends to even more distantly related features, such as the organs with which partners grasp each other during sex, which Darwin also explains by natural selection. Again, a quote from Darwin. "The males of many oceanic crustaceans, when adult, have their legs and antennae modified in an extraordinary manner for the prehension of the female. Hence, we may suspect that it is because these animals are washed about by the waves of the open sea that they require these organs in order to propagate their kind, and if so, their development has been the result of ordinary or natural selection." End quote. So here again, the ability to better hold on to the sexual partner supports the reproduction in a natural sort of way, and therefore it's natural selection. Sexual selection, in contrast, makes itself known in those characteristics that have little other function, or at least whose primary function is, to gain an advantage over other members of the species of the same sex, in having the opportunity to mate and thus pass on their genes to the next generation. These secondary sexual characteristics are as numerous and diverse as there are species in nature, but they include, and again Darwin, the weapons of offense and the means of defense of the males for fighting with and driving away their rivals, their courage and pugnacity, their various ornaments, their contrivances for producing vocal or instrumental music, and their glands for emitting odors, end quote. One might add to this list also the performances in courtship. A little crudely put then, secondary sexual features comprise anything that helps individuals of one sex to draw attention to the other sex, to him or herself. The two main factors at play here are: one, fighting among the members of the more numerous sex over privileged access to the other sex. This can take place either through gaining the right to mate, or simply by driving away and thus reducing the number of competitors. And two, the aesthetic preferences of the less numerous sex, which for Darwin hold a decisive influence on the mating choices. Although on first sight one might pick up on the gendered overtures of these principles, it is after all mostly males who fight over females in Darwin, these battles are not the most decisive aspect of sexual selection. Quite to the opposite, success in winning over competitors does neither always involve fighting, nor is it necessarily the winner that ends up mating. Moreover, the process of sexual selection is not restricted to sexually dimorphic species, that is, species where the sexes exhibit different characteristics.
Do you have another example?
Another quote from Darwin: "The gastropoda, snails and sloths, though capable of locomotion and furnished with imperfect eyes, do not appear to be endowed with sufficient mental powers for the members of the same sex to struggle together in rivalry, and thus to acquire secondary sexual characters. Nevertheless, with the palmoniferous gastropods, or land snails, the pairing is preceded by courtship. For these animals, though hermaphrodites, are compelled by their structures to pair together." And this is this courtship. Moving into the act of cross-fertilization now. "Thus, even though they do not develop morphological secondary sexual characters, they nevertheless do so in relation to their behaviors." Another example in Darwin is the Virginian goatsucker or nighthawk, of which he writes, "In some cases, the pairing precedes instead of succeeds the combat. Thus, according to Audubon, several males of the Virginian goatsucker court in a highly entertaining manner the female, and no sooner has she made her choice than her approved gives chase to all intruders and drives them beyond his dominion." End quote. Whereas the females of the nighthawk thus dominate courtship rituals, certain wood grouses seem to disregard species conventions and courtship etiquette altogether. Again, a quote from Darwin. "Generally, the males try to drive away or kill their rivals before they pair. It does not, however, appear that the females invariably prefer the victorious males. I have indeed been assured by Dr. Kowalewski that the female wood grouse sometimes steals away with a young male who is not there to enter the arena with the older cocks, in the same manner as occasionally happens with the does of the red deer in Scotland."
Can you stop the film? It's a different film.
Oh, okay.
Still pretty.
No more slides, so just leave it there. Scotland, end quote. So whereas battles and thus mechanisms removed from individual choices do factor into the selection of mating partners, a decisive part of sexual selection is actually based on individual aesthetic sexual attraction. And this attraction plays a significant role also in a species' habits of life, as becomes so vivid in peacocks. Their tails, after all, significantly impact upon the bird's range and ability to maneuver. Moreover, the attraction extends beyond physical morphological features and characteristics to various behaviors. And just for some variety, I throw in some fish because they tend to be so often underrepresented, which was not the case here. beginning the quote, "The male stickleback has been described as mad with delight when the female comes out of her hiding place and surveys the nest which he has made for her. He darts round her in every direction, then to his accumulated materials for the nest, then back again in an instant. And as she does not advance, he endeavors to push her with his snout and then tries to pull her by the tail and sidespine to the nest." End quote. So I come to my conclusion, or sort of what I hope this kind of made visible a little bit more. By exhibiting preferences for the aesthetic qualities of certain individuals of a species, and thus providing these individuals with the specific aesthetic features an advantage in reproducing themselves, the development and appearance of species in respect to their secondary sexual characters can be considered a result of the species' own making. By thus shaping the future appearance and behavior of their species, animals exert some, if somewhat restricted, form of historical agency through the aesthetic choices they are making, and the way in which these will influence, restrict, and pre-structure the habits and ways of life the species can pursue. These choices might not be rational, that is, they might not be shaped by some reckoning with the results and consequences of these choices, but they nevertheless display a form of agency, an influencing of the future forms and behaviors of their species. As this making not only affects accessory features, but shapes and interferes with their behaviors and habits of life, we thus might be able to speak of species making their own history, or rather their own future. The kind of agency that comes into view then is both historical and aesthetic in kind. Or more precisely, probably, it is an aesthetic agency that is executed in the sexual act and manifests itself historically in the changes or refinement of the aesthetics of animals. From their ornaments to their sexually related armaments, from their songs to their mating dances, from their physical sexual features to the artistic displays they are constructing to impress and win over sexual partners. Darwin's concept of sexual selection, then, not only provides us with a concept of agency that is orientated towards the self-preferences of individual species, rather than measuring the agency of animals up against what we perceive to be our own agency, for example, how complex their social relations are, how human-like they communicate, if they have a consciousness that resembles our own, their ability to reason, and so on. Instead, I want to suggest within the secondary sexual characteristics of animals opens up a potential for making visible and graspable an individual agency that perceives animals in their own right. And I have a little addendum to that. So it's always the difficulty when talking about history for the current time. There remains a serious danger of anachronism, obviously. Much of what Darwin wrote was already contested during his own time, or still, you might say. And a lot of the empirical observations do not necessarily hold up against scrutiny. There's also a gender problem in Darwin's text that will have to be scrutinized, in that sexes prove much less rigid and clearly assignable, as we heard yesterday, for example. And moreover, a thorough consideration of the sexual characteristics of animals as an expression of animal agency would have to take into account the last 100 years of research. However, Darwin remains, even after this long time, the main point of reference for the discourse on sexual selection at large, while the process itself still remains sparsely understood, even though it has been studied to a large degree. The main controversy, as far as my oversight reaches right now, seems to be over what animals are choosing for and who is doing the choosing. In other words, it seems commonly agreed that animals do choose their mating partners. Some biologists continue to argue along Darwinian lines, advocating aesthetic preference that are not correlated with any particular factor of fitness. Richard Prum, for example, he published a very popular book last year on that issue. And others suggest reproductive social behavior would be aimed at fashioning a social infrastructure that produces an increased number of offspring, tying it closer to natural selection. That's actually what Jordan Rogarden suggests, whom we have heard of yesterday shortly, briefly. So rather than no agency, the alternative here would be an aesthetic or a social agency. Maybe the ongoing uncertainty about sexual selection lends credibility to the scientifically more challenging soft criterion of an aesthetic preference. Yet either way, the current debate seems to support my suggestions more than to undermine them. Thank you.